Welcome to Enclave On Air. I'm your host today, Chris Ryan. Enclave On Air is a podcast from Enclave, which provides oncology professionals with the resources and information they need to provide the best patient care. In both digital and print formats, Enclave covers every angle of oncology practice, from new technology to treatment advances to important regulatory decisions. In today's episode, sponsored by GlycoMyMedics, we have the pleasure of speaking with Dr. Michael Andreeff about the evaluation of uproleselan for the treatment of patients with acute myeloid leukemia. Dr. Andreeff is a professor of medicine and holds the Paul and Mary Haas Chair in Genetics at the University of Texas MD Anderson Cancer Center in Houston. In our exclusive interview, Dr. Andreeff discussed the novel first-in-class E-selectin antagonist uproleselan, the rationale for targeting E-selectin in patients with the AML, how uproleselan could amplify the effects of chemotherapy in the treatment of these patients, and other ongoing research evaluating uproleselan in combination with other agents. Okay, Dr. Andreeff, so just to start, what is the rationale of targeting E-selectin, and what is the role of E-selectin within the tumor microenvironment for this malignancy?
The vast majority of research in leukemias is focusing on the leukemic cells and maybe on the leukemic stem cells defined by a number of markers. What has been under-investigated in general is the role of the microenvironment. Leukemic cells, like all cancer cells, don't live on plastic, right? You don't see plastic when you do an autopsy. So they have a microenvironment, which in this case is the bone marrow, complicated organ with many different cells. And in the last few years, people paid a lot of attention to the immune microenvironment, which of course is important, but there are other cell types that are probably equally important. One cell type are the mesenchymal stem cells, and they have been investigated now for many years. A major target there is CXCR4, and the ligand is SDF1. SDF1 is produced by stroma cells. CXCR4 is on the leukemic cells and leukemic stem cells, and it's a major survival factor. What has not been so well investigated is the vascular niche. The vascular niche is obviously also important. There is actually no clear distinction between the endosteal niche and the vascular niche. It's really one composite niche, and people have always separated these two niches, but functionally, it's really one organ, of course. And so one of the factors in the vascular niche is E-selectin. There was no drug available to target this, but GMI made a compound that targets E-selectin. This has been in clinical trials, or is in clinical trial right now. A phase 3 trial is ongoing. Results will probably take another 9 months or so, but the phase 2 study looked good. What was observed is that the responses are better. That means a probably deeper response to induction therapy, and longer remission durations, because the interaction of leukemic cells with the vascular niche is disrupted. So in a nutshell, I think that is the major finding. In addition, what was seen was a myeloprotective effect. So the platelet counts in particular, or white cells in the clinical trial, neutrophils, recovered faster in the presence of E-selectin inhibition. So when we started working on this, which is now many years ago, we observed that we had a lot of healthy megakaryocytes in the marrow. And that would also play into this notion that it's not only that the leukemic cells are more susceptible to chemotherapy and perhaps venetoclax therapy, but also that the normal hematopoietic cells are to a degree protected, which of course is wonderful because it would shorten the time to platelet recovery and neutrophil recovery.
So you mentioned uproleselan. Can you expand a little bit just about how it kind of works in conjunction with chemotherapy to amplify these responses in patients with AML?
It disrupts the interaction with the vascular niche, as I said. So it's very similar in a way, like the SDF1 CXCR4 axis that links the stroma cells to the leukemic cells. Actually, the company has a combination drug, which is not yet in clinical trials, which does both. It inhibits CXCR4 and E-selectin. And so we have conducted pretty extensive studies, and we presented that at ASH and recently in London at a EHA microenvironment meeting. So we see that the combination drug is much more effective than the selectin inhibitor. But no, like every small company, they have to take small steps before they can run. So right now, the important event will be the outcome of the randomized phase three trial. If that's positive, I'm sure they will move forward and put the combined inhibitor into clinical trials.
You mentioned the phase three trial in combination with chemotherapy. There's also another phase three study looking at the addition of uprelestilin to venetoclax and azacitidine. Just what is the rationale of investigating uprelestilin within that setting?
We have looked at the microenvironment stroma cells for 18 years now. And what's happening is that CXCR4 is signaling into the leukemic cells via a transcription factor called Yin-Yang-1. It's very interesting because I give talks about microenvironment and leukemia and the yin and yang. And one day, my Chinese postdoc came and said, there is a transcription factor called YY1, which is immediately downstream of CXCR4. The signaling that is downstream of E-selectin is not YY1, so these are alternative pathways, but blocking E-selectin, number one, detaches the cells from the vascular niche, but also affects intracellular signaling pathways. And of course, ideally, we want to cut off both supply structures in the marrow, the MSCs and the vascular niche, and that can be achieved with the dual inhibitor.
Going back a little bit to the chemotherapy and uprelestilin combination, with the potential to improve outcomes and also rates of minimal residual disease, what is the kind of significance of MRD negativity within AML?
Yeah, so there are myriad studies that all show the same thing, and that is the presence of MRD is a bad prognostic sign. And actually, MRD supersedes all other prognostic factors, which in a way is no surprise. It just means there is leukemia left. So it's really not a prognostic factor because it's established at the end of cycle one or cycle two. It's really a better measure of sensitivity of the leukemic cells. What people don't talk about is that 40% of patients who are MRD negative by flow cytometry relapse. So there has to be an improvement how we determine MRD. What is done routinely now is to look for mutations by PCR. So that would be FLT3 mutations, NPM1 mutations, and that increases sensitivity or detectability of detectable minimal disease. That's the correct term, down to 10 to the minus 4 or something in that range. While flow cytometry is good for 1 in 1,000, 10 to the minus 3. So one log more matters because we are now picking up positivity that we would miss by flow cytometry. We have worked now for about 5 years on doing the next step. It's okay to identify these cells, and I think in the future, this will be done bidirectional, error-corrected, deep DNA sequencing. That is probably the best method. Other methods are ddPCR, which is also very sensitive, maybe even more sensitive, down to minus 5. But for that, you need to know exactly what to look for to do this specific PCRs. Flow cytometry can probably be improved. And there is two major projects ongoing. One is from the NCI. The NCI wants to standardize the MRD detection, and there's a consortium that's working on it. And there is also an organization called Breakthrough Cancer, Breakthrough Cancer, a foundation that has brought together now MIT, Dana-Farber, Sloan Kettering, Johns Hopkins, and MD Anderson, my institution. And we are working on the MRD aspect in several ways. Number one, we are comparing different techniques, single-cell sequencing, improved flow cytometry, and looking for soluble DNA. So mutations that are not cell restricted, but in the plasma. Very exciting because in solid tumors, this is being established now as a very sensitive way to look for residual cells. And interestingly, there are mutations that are seen that way that are not seen when you sequence individual cells. That means there may be a metastasis somewhere with a different mutation that is spilling DNA into circulation and can be detected. So very exciting new technologies. Single-cell sequencing, of course, after one would sort stem cells. So that's one aspect. The other aspect is to molecularly characterize these minimal residual disease cells. And what we want to know is what's overexpressed in these cells. And this will be different between different treatment protocols. So if you treat with Ara-C-based treatment, I'm pretty sure, but nobody has shown that, that the quality of the MRD cell is different. Different genes are overexpressed compared to when you treat with venetoclax-based therapies. So this is a project that we have worked on for a few years, and now it's a project in this breakthrough cancer thing. One of the exciting possibilities is to detect neoantigens on these cells that are not present when leukemia is diagnosed. So the immunotherapy in AML has been limited in its efficacy, as most people know. In our CAR T cells, engager T cells, NK cells, antibodies, antibody drug conjugates, all have about 20% response rate, but not more than that. And that has been, it's very different from lymphoid malignancies. So what we need is better targets, because the targets that everybody is now going after is CD123, CLL1, maybe CD33, not that exciting, and certainly not specific for the leukemic cells. So once we map the surface of residual cells, we will very likely discover neoepitopes, and then we can make immune cells against these epitopes. So this is the latest in MRD. This will take another decade to come to fruition. But immunotherapy, because the cell number is so much lower, induction therapy kills, let's say, at least 3 logs, maybe 4 logs of cells. So it will be easier for immune therapy to mop up the residual cells.
Could you walk me through maybe a couple other novel targets such as FLT3, TP53, IDH1 that are under investigation within AML and could potentially lead to some more targeted therapies?
We have learned how to target a few mutations, but when you really step back, this goes on for 15 or 20 years. And what do we have? We have FLT3, and the FLT3 inhibitors clearly made an impact, but they are not curative. And even after transplant, you need a FLT3 inhibitor to prevent relapse, and that was very effective, actually. Then you have IDH1, IDH2, clearly effective compounds. And in that case, venetoclax is extremely effective. And I think IDH2 mutations treated with venetoclax plus HMA can be cured to a degree that way, because these cells are highly sensitive to BCL2 inhibition. We don't have a good NRAS inhibitor yet. PTPN11 is a problem. We don't have anything specific for that. SHP2 inhibitors are under investigation. So we are running out of targets. P53, of course, is the highest hanging fruit, and there is no drug that targets P53, certainly not APR246, because that drug did really not change the conformation of P53. This drug induced ROS, which killed leukemic cells. There is activity, but there is no preferential killing of P53 mutant cells, and clinical trials have been negative recently. There is one drug that is, to my knowledge, the only specific drug that's developed by a company called PVM Pharma. It targets a specific P53 mutation, which is a Y220C. Very rare, 1% of solid tumors, and probably the same number of leukemias, AMLs, have this mutation. This mutation lacks a portion in its DNA binding domain, so the mutation doesn't allow activation of transcription that wild-type P53 does. And it's a pretty small region, and this has been filled by a small molecule. So the principle is very elegant, And Arnie Levine and others have shown that this agent induces massive apoptosis preclinically. So this is in clinical trials now in solid tumors. It was presented at ASCO last year, 25%, 30% response rates, PRs, no CRs, but it's probably a good first step. And obviously, one needs to develop combination therapies. But that is the first time that mutant P53, but only one particular mutation, can be converted into a wild-type conformation, which would then signal cell death, apoptosis, and so on. The other drug that is effective, but non-specific in 53 mutations, of course, is magrolimab and the other CD47 SERP1 inhibitors. Unfortunately, 53 patients have a high response rate in the order of 50%, but they relapse at a steady clip, unfortunately. So we have to come in with new approaches for MRD following CD47 antibody treatment, which causes this eat me signal, right? So the macrophages are now eating not P53 cells in particular, but they are agnostic in that regard. So that's the best therapy now that we have for P53 mutants, but it's not the end of the story. The relapse rate is very high. We now have combinations in clinical trials with venetoclax HMA. HMA upregulates CD47. There's a good rationale for that. And venetoclax lowers the apoptotic threshold. So I think this will be a step forward, but we still have a long way to go with P53 mutations. And that's where it really stops at this point. There are splice mutants, of course, mutations that are being targeted. Omar Al-Wahab and Sloan Kettering has some very interesting drugs under development. There are many other new targeted agents, but they're all very, very early. RAS would be nice, and people are working on NRAS, targeting NRAS, not just KRAS. KRAS doesn't help us because it's very rare in AMLs, so we need a NRAS or a PANRAS targeted agent. MYC is a very interesting target, has not been successfully targeted. We have presented data at ASH for a MYC degrader that we are developing. So that's, of course, very early, very preclinical. It will take time to bring this into the clinic. So these are the big targets, P53, wild type and mutant, MYC, wild type. 20% of the entire transcriptome depends on MYC. So once we can target it, we will have very effective treatments. And we have to learn how to use it, of course. So we have a long ways to go, but we shouldn't forget that we have so many new drugs available now that we didn't have 10 years ago and even 5 years ago. So I think we are finally on the right path to cure AML. The other big drug development is menin inhibition. So the MLL fusion leukemias have been horrible. When patients relapse, there is no effective treatment. And now we have a response rate of 30%. 90% of patients are minimal residual or detectable residual disease negative. So these are drugs developed by Syndax and other companies. And what's very interesting is the downstream is NPM1 mutant cells, which we couldn't target until now. And there's some evidence that NPM1 mutations can be targeted by inhibiting menin. So that's a very exciting development now. Recently, a Nature paper was published on this. And in the same Nature issue, the resistance mechanism was defined, namely mutation in the menin gene. Maybe no surprise, but we know what to look for now when we see resistance to these menin inhibitors. The field is moving very fast, and we still have a long ways to go to cure all our patients.
Based on all these different targeted therapies being developed and in still in very early studies, how might like agents like uproleselan, some of the other things you talked about, kind of help address and move this paradigm forward within AML?
We need more patients in clinical trials. In the United States, a very small number of patients are in clinical trials. And the number is going down, actually, and not up, which is very, very surprising. So the best way to develop these things is to do phase 1, phase 2 trials with very good molecular endpoints and put patients on these trials. And actually, recently, I think our group published that patients on phase 1, phase 2 trials have a longer life expectancy than patients who are not, because they get certainly have better supportive care, they may benefit from these drugs, at least temporarily, and they get everybody's undivided attention vis-a-vis a patient who is being sent home, maybe on low-dose IRC or on HMA only, which, of course, has no effect on survival, really. So I would encourage everybody who is listening and who has patients to refer the at least refractory leukemia patients to centers that do clinical trials.
That's all we have for today. Thank you for listening to this episode of OncLive On Air, sponsored by GlycoMimetics. Check back on Mondays and Thursdays for exclusive interviews with leading experts in the oncology field. For more updates in oncology, be sure to visit www.onclive.com and sign up for our e-newsletters. OncLive is also on social media. On Twitter, follow us at OncLive and at OncLiveSOSS. On Facebook, like us at OncLive and OncLive State of the Science Summit, and follow our OncLive page on LinkedIn. If you like today's episode of OncLive On Air, please consider subscribing to our podcast on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Google Podcasts, Amazon Music, and many of your other favorite podcast platforms, so you get a notification every time a new episode is posted. While you are there, please take a moment to rate us. Thanks again for listening to OncLive On Air.